This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Media, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Pete Kunze. My guest today is Tanya Sutherland, an assistant professor of information studies at UCLA and the author of Resurrecting the Black Body, Race in the Digital Afterlife. The book was published by the University of California Press in 2023. Good afternoon, Tanya, and welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Thank you so much for having me, Pete. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is mine. I'm glad we were able to connect and discuss this book, which I think is so rich and will give us a lot to dig into. And hopefully we'll send people out to buy a copy because we'll only be able to scratch the surface. To begin with, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your training?
Absolutely. So I have an undergraduate degree from Hampshire College in theater, performance studies, history, and cultural studies. And I will say that a lot of that performance studies orientation has influenced the work that you see in this book. And then I also have a master's in library and information sciences from the University of Pittsburgh and a PhD in archival studies from the University of Pittsburgh. I made my career and living for quite some time as a performing artist, doing theater and dance in the Bay Area, and then started off actually as a children's librarian and doing some mending of videotapes and such at the Oakland Public Library. So I sort of come out of a combination of library studies and performance studies, and that sort of brought me to this archival studies space where I think about all of these things together. It's very interdisciplinary.
I was wondering if you had a creative writing background, because I felt like certain passages of this were very like personal and essayistic and beautiful. So I'm glad to hear that you have an artistic background. I think it comes through in your work really nicely.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about why archiving and memory work are at the center of your book project? Like, what kind of drew you into the idea of kind of theorizing and critiquing this area of the humanities in particular?
Absolutely. So as I talk a little bit about in the introduction to the book, the work sort of started for me in 2005 in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And what I observed was that in online spaces, nascent sort of online spaces, and also on television, that there were I was seeing a lot of Black bodies, and you know, it's the aftermath of Katrina. There's a lot of death. The media is trying to sort of portray to us the devastation that's happening in this city and in New Orleans. And what sort of connected for me, because I was finishing up my master's degree in library and information science with a concentration on archival studies, what was sort of what sort of really landed for me was this is going to become archival material. This is going to become the basis for future historical projects. This is going to be like, these images are going to be the thing that future scholars build their work on, and that, you know, historians return to, and that we as an American public look back on when we want to recall what happened during Katrina and in the aftermath of the storm. And it recalled for me as a child seeing a lot of images from the Save the Children campaigns in, you know, from Ethiopia, and how it was, you know, these images too are sort of this stark depiction of Black people suffering and pain, Black degradation in many ways, and how these images were being used to sort of mobilize a public response. But I don't think anybody was thinking about 100 years from now, when folks look back and they're trying to craft a history, craft an historical narrative. This is the detritus that they're going to be left with, right? This is what they're going to have to work with. And it became very much an archival project, a question of inclusion and exclusion, and what should be in the record, what should not be in the record. And then, you know, who should have access to those kinds of materials, because the ways that they get mobilized and then sometimes weaponized, commercialized, as I talk about in the book, really have an impact on the people and the people who survive them, the people in those images, and then those that survive them.
So this is a bit of a painfully obvious question, I'm sure, for a scholar like yourself, but for the sake of readers coming to your work, can you discuss the importance of centering corporality in that inquiry, both in terms of, I guess, physicality, but also affect and emotionality?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I think, really easy to look at pictures of any kind of pain or trauma and have an emotional distancing and affective distancing. On one hand, there may be an affective call, right? And then sort of an affective call and response, where you see someone, you see an image of someone in pain, you feel that pain yourself, or you feel some element of that, you corporealize it yourself in some ways, right? Especially for those of us that are particularly empathic. But what tends to happen when we, so, I mean, there's something sort of tactile and material, I suppose, about holding images like that. If you have a printed copy, you're holding it in your hand. There's something really very visceral about that experience. Whereas when you have the mediation of the screen, and it's a lot easier to kind of distance yourself from the affective impact of that trauma, of the pain that the other person is experiencing. It's a little bit easier, and, you know, not to veer too far. I think this is the root of some of the poorly argued video games are making us all violent, right? There's an emotional distancing and affective distancing that does happen. And while I'm not arguing at all that video games make us more violent people, I will stand by the argument that there is there is sort of a separation that becomes permissible when you are viewing things through a screen. And so it was really important to me to focus on what the physical body actually experiences, the real human beings, and whether their lives are extraordinary or ordinary or extraordinary really doesn't matter. It's that we are all people and we feel pain the same way. If I pinch you, if I pinch me, we're gonna mostly feel that pain similarly. And I think some of that gets lost when you stop taking the body really into consideration, the humanity of it, right?
Yeah, I was thinking as a historian, right, how much of historiographic practice is invested in the idea of we have an obligation to the past, we have an obligation to truth, we have an obligation to uncover what happened, right? And it struck me in reading your work how kind of white and Western and masculinist that idea is, as opposed to our obligations to the subjects, and who gets to be remembered and how they get to be remembered and how their memory gets used in that process. And it struck me that your work is very much kind of offering that kind of Black feminist critique of that kind of like, we're historians and we're memory workers, we're archivists, we do our commitment is to the truth above all else, right?
That's right.
I'm wondering what you think about that. I mean, do you see that as very much kind of part of your project of like, maybe we need to rethink this approach to how we treat and carry forth the past into the future?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a little bit inside baseball, but I will tell you that in the, art in the field of archival studies, and then also in the profession of archives, there's a very long tradition of sort of documentary practices that are really just about that, right? Like evidence of human activity. That's what we're here to capture. That's what we're here to document. The archival tradition kind of comes out of this French tradition that's really just about the French governmental archives. Comes out of the, like, archivists first get trained at the École des Chartres in Paris. And it's really just about training archivists to deal with government records so that historians can access them. So we kind of get this this history of archivists serving as handmaidens to history, right? This long trajectory, rather, of archivists serving as handmaidens to history. And in a lot of ways, American archivy has pushed back against that. And so in this country in particular, we have a dual tradition that's both a historical manuscripts tradition and also a tradition that comes out of government records and government documents. And somewhere in the middle of that, probably 10 or 15 years ago, maybe as many as 20, but I think that's kind of stretching, folks started to say, hey, well, that's not all this is about, right? It's not just about documenting what our governments are doing. And it's not just this historical manuscripts tradition. There are all kinds of memory work that have been practiced around the globe. And we can't just take this very white European French tradition that then spread to England and Australia and Canada, and in many ways to the US, right? We can't just take this longstanding tradition as whole and as fast when we have so many other rich traditions of history keeping and memory making and memory keeping and record keeping that need to be seen and viewed and reflected. And so much of that, as you say, as you so rightly point out, comes through re-envisioning the archives as not just something that documents, but is also the purview of the documented, right? And so we start to have conversations about whether or not Indigenous people want to be included in these archival spaces that have not been created with them in mind. And then you have Black folks and this very Black feminist approach that says, I don't, like, this is a space that's actually trying to destroy me. Why would I want to be a part of that? And so you start seeing sort of alternate modes of memory work being respected and celebrated. And I think that's the moment that we are in right now. And I'm so happy that my work, my book gets to contribute to that, because that is exactly the thing that this sort of turning a ship that has been slowly sailing in one direction for a really long time, slowly turning it around. You know, this book is part of that process, the recentering of the subject, the understanding that, you know, that truth is relative to the individual that's represented, and all of those things.
Thank you for walking us through that. Many of the listeners to New Books in Media, as you can imagine, are media study scholars or comm scholars who may be engaging with these questions in their work, but, you know, aren't necessarily as aware of what's happening in library science and information studies as you are. And I'm glad that we have an opportunity to come together and think through these concerns together. One of the things that struck me, though, in reading your work as someone who's invested in coming at it from critical media studies, is I was thinking of the rich body of scholarship, especially in recent years, on technology and anti-Blackness. Do you see yourself here in conversation with Sophia Noble and Ruha Benjamin and kind of that kind of rethinking and complication of the idea that technology is somehow apolitical, that technology is somehow operating beyond the constraints of structural racism? It's a bit of a loaded question.
Yes, I'm 100% in conversation with wonderful, wonderful scholars like Safiya and Ruha, like Simone Brown, like Catherine Knight Steele, like Andre Brock, Raven Miraj Singh. I think Raven Miraj Lloyd. There are so many of us that are thinking in this space about the confluence of race and technology, digital studies, media. And we really are, I think, collectively and individually pushing back against this notion that of neutrality in any way, shape, or form, right? The technology is built by humans and humans are flawed. It's designed by humans and humans are flawed. The media environment in which we find ourselves is one that is constructed also by very flawed humans. And the more we can be in conversation with each other and not assume some sort of technological determinism, right? There can be low-tech solutions and high-tech solutions to any given problem. We don't have to, technological solutionism, technological determinism. We don't have to assume that the best solution to any given problem is a technological one. And we also cannot assume that technology isn't imbued with all of the same isms that our society is imbued with. Why would our technologies not reflect the same racism and sexism and homophobia and anti-transness and, you know, ableism that we see reflected throughout our society when these are tools that are built by humans in our society, right? And so any notion that we could build technology that is otherwise is so foreign to me that it's just sort of borders on being laughable, but is, you know, it's more serious than that. And so it then becomes actually a bit offensive.
So in order to kind of think through these issues, right, you're working in this idea of the digital afterlife in particular. And I have to be honest with you, in addition to the work you're doing here in thinking through like Black studies and Black media studies, in addition to obviously your own orientation in information studies, it was this digital afterlife that really got me thinking like, oh, I have to read this, right? Can you tell us what that concept means to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, while we're living, while we're here on this planet and moving around in this technological age, we are creating so much data every day. every single day we are, there's email, there, you know, everything that we're doing on our phones, we're taking pictures, there's data, there's metadata. I can't remember exactly the number right now, but, you know, each human is producing like terabytes of data every single day. And that might be extreme. It might be extreme. There are tremendous amounts of data being produced by each and every single human on this planet every day. And then you die. And, you know, Facebook has dipped a toe into this and said, okay, well, we've got some considerations for your digital afterlife. You know, we've got some like digital afterlife estate planners who are like, okay, this person has died. They're no longer with us. What do we do with all of this data, all of this detritus, all of these digital remains? Do we, you know, flush them? I mean, this data is very valuable, right? So there hasn't really been a lot of conversation in this, what happens to the data after somebody dies space. And the National Institutes of Health are concerned about medical data, for example, right? Especially in a post-COVID moment where I won't say that we're in a post-COVID moment, but in a post-pandemic lockdown, you know, it was the center of our universe for 2 years moment, you know, reckoning with all of that pandemic data and the data of the people who died. I mean, just the health and medical data alone has been something that has sort of taken over in terms of a problem space, but not in terms of we have a ton of solutions for this. So I think that there's actually an opportunity here for a lot of us to do some thinking about the digital afterlife and what happens to all of this data. I mean, we can't keep every human's data in perpetuity responsibly, I mean, environmentally responsibly, for one, but for a host of other reasons, right? Like, we already know that data storage is becoming an increasing problem. We're starting to see folks wanting to install undersea data systems just off the coast so that we have more data storage, faster data communication. And I mean, at a certain point, what are we going to do with all of that data? It becomes a matter of being able to access it. It becomes a matter of being able to store it and retrieve it. And, you know, I think there's just a lot to think about there. And we've just started to scratch the surface because exponentially every day we're creating more and more and more data.
So then I have the question that I ask folks when I interview them that makes me feel like I'm their dissertation advisor. So apologies for that. I hope it doesn't bring up any traumatizing memories. But when you're taking on something so big, how do you think about that, right? Especially since many of our listeners are early career scholars who are writing their dissertations or writing their first books. I mean, what did it mean for you as a scholar kind of coming into your own to kind of think about, I'm going to talk about this huge issue and try to make it legible and accessible and honestly to do it as well as you did here. So I'm just wondering kind of a little bit of the process there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I started thinking about this, like I said, in 2005. I returned to it after the death of Mike Brown. And it was around the time that I was finishing up my dissertation and defending my dissertation. And so I was very much sort of poised for what is my next project. And I had been thinking about this for quite some time. And it really helped me, I think, that I was in that moment where I had finished up my dissertation and I had been told, this is your first project, not your only project. And I'd been really well guided and well advised by my committee and my dissertation advisor about scope, right? And about boundaries and about keeping a project bounded. And there, I could have written a book. And, you know, in the early days, I thought I might be writing a book about digital remains in general, about digital afterlives in general. And then I thought, well, what aspect of this work is really important to me? And it was about seeing those bodies in, you know, in after Katrina. It was about the Save the Children campaign and these, you know, these depictions of starving Ethiopian children with distended bellies and overly thin arms, and the ways that Black people in particular were being put out into the media, the callousness with which our pain was being displayed. And I think it helped me to scope the project around Blackness and around race. And for newer scholars or for those who are just thinking about writing a first book, I will say too that I had a really brilliant and wonderful editor at UC Press, Michelle Lipinski. Mad props to Michelle, who, when I first approached her to talk about this, I, you know, said a lot of things about how big I wanted the scope of the project to be, and, you know, how I really wanted to talk about race. And she really encouraged me to hone in on the race aspects of the project and to not be afraid to write a book about race, whereas my dissertation advisor had kind of discouraged the same kind of project, right? It's not going to be saleable. It's not going to be widely read. People aren't going to care about this. And, you know, I now know as a slightly more senior scholar that those things just aren't true. And you have to write what's in front of you. You have to write the story that moves you. You have to tell the story that needs to be told. And so that's what I did here. And I'm just really grateful that it's resonating.
Yeah. Speaking of resonating, I must admit, it took me a while to get through the introduction, not because of the way you write, certainly not because of the way you write, but because there were so many moments where concisely, and at times even lyrically, you acknowledge and state and argue for something that I was like, oh, like this needs a pause, right? And so if you won't mind me reading a bit of your book to you, I'd love for you to unpack this a bit further for the listeners. You said that early in the introduction, you say, I learned then that to monetize the white savior complex, American society must valorize Black suffering. I also learned that to diminish the perceived impact of white suffering, white Americans must see and believe that Black people are suffering more. And, you know, I teach a lot of film studies, and it reminded me of bell hooks responding to the film Beasts of the Southern Wild. And there was so much talk at the time of how brilliant this film was and how brilliant Quvenzhané Wallace was, right? And what artistry this narrative. And bell hooks writes this kind of brilliant essay where she's like, why does the Black child need to suffer in the name of, you know, brilliant white art, right? Because the filmmaker was not a Black filmmaker. Can you talk about that relationship and how white supremacy is operating there?
Yeah, the white gaze is so oppositional, right? So it feels like, and it has been borne out in so many texts, whether those are visual texts or written texts or, you know, any other kind of text that we might study as scholars, that whiteness needs something to operate against. And in this country, that has traditionally been Blackness. And so in order for whiteness to appear to be successful, then Blackness must not be successful, right? There must, it's a yin and yang almost. It's a conversation of opposites all of the time. You know, the white woman is pure, and is allowed to maintain a sense of purity because the Black woman has been villainized, and there is something for that purity to be compared to and against. And so you have an entire nation that has built so much of its social structure around this oppositional gaze, that in order for for a white figure to be seen as somehow sacrosanct, you need to have the black villain. You have to, it's, and I mean, this is, I mean, it's the good and evil narrative playing out. It's the black and white narrative playing out. It's a tale as old as time, right? And the way that we see it play out in this country is on and against the black body. And, you know, I say that I use the black body there both as like a site of study and also as a very human, experiential, flesh-based kind of pain experience.
Yeah, it reminded me also of my days as a literature scholar and reading Toni Morrison's Playing in the Dark, right? Where it's the whiteness's need for blackness to reinforce its whiteness. And the way that, as you articulated, that kind of plays out in these affective economies as well, right? Like it's not just about the being, it's about the feeling, right? And I think that that's really useful for readers to kind of sit with. I wanted to transition to your discussion of images coming out of chattel slavery and how those images not only are archived, but how they're used. You spend a great deal of time talking about this, but I was hoping you could provide a bit of a cursory introduction to what drew you to that topic in particular to kind of start off your chapters discussion, and also what you're kind of pushing against in that process as a scholar and practitioner and a theorist.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much beautiful thinking to be done in there. There's a scholar named Temi Odumosu who is at UW, University of Washington in Seattle. And Temi has this gorgeous article called The Crying Child. And if you haven't read it, I'm telling everyone to please go read Temi Odumosu's The Crying Child. And in it, she talks about how there is, there's this image of a child who has been photographed, and the child is crying tears. You can visibly see tears on this young child. It's the child is a toddler on their face. And she talks about how this cry is silenced by the archives, right? How you can see, and you can see that this child is in pain, but what you can't hear the sound of that child crying. Similarly, there is a gorgeous piece of writing that talks similarly about the silences of the archives and the ways that you might read about a woman, an enslaved woman being raped or sexually assaulted or you know, assaulted in some way, shape, or form. And again, that what you can't hear are the screams of this person experiencing an assault, right? And there was a conversation that was happening at the time in archival studies about how, and Daniela Angostino is another person who writes about this, and she's coming out of Denmark and writing about the colonial archives of Denmark and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And so there's this notion that you have these digitized artifacts, these digitized archival materials that have been digitized by the archives ostensibly for access purposes, right? So the idea is, oh, this thing is very old and it's very fragile. We don't want people to come in. We make touch it. It'll fall apart and then nobody will be able to use it. We make a preservation copy so that people can come in and have that tactile experience, that visceral experience that you and I talked about earlier, Pete. But then for broader access, the conversation in the archival studies world and the archival profession for a long time has been, we need to digitize to make things available to a broader audience of people. Great, wonderful. Except here we are on Beyonce's internet. And the truth of the matter is that when you digitize something and you post it to the internet, it doesn't stay within that context. It doesn't stay on the page of the Library of Congress. It doesn't stay on, you know, the page of whatever archives or the repository has digitized it, but rather I'm going to do a save picture as or save video as, and then I'm going to put it up on my own website, or I'm going to post it to Twitter, or I'm going to post it to Instagram or TikTok. And now this image is circulating completely out of context. And without that context, it starts to lose not only some of its meaning, but again, some of that affective impact, that affective economy, as we talked about. And as these things start to circulate out of context, they begin to take on new meaning. And that new meaning may or may not be imbued or imbibed with the same sort of moral, social, cultural values, historical values that are, or even like the lens to view those things that would allow you to understand them in the context of their creation. And that's really important when we're talking about things like things that document human enslavement, human pain, human trauma. The sort of digital afterlives of the archives of American slavery are a particularly jarring and difficult set of documents to deal with as they begin to circulate in these new contexts. I'm thinking here too of the daguerreotypes that Harvard has of Renty and Delia, and the way that, you know, Harvard has sort of doubled down on the Peabody Museum has sort of doubled down on, we own these are our property. And because of this whole conversation about these daguerreotypes, they are now, I mean, you do a Google image search and you've got these two images and you don't know what they are. You don't know exactly what you're looking at. You don't know what relationship it is that you're supposed to have to them. And so you invent a relationship, you invent a narrative, you invent a story, and they have no control over that. Their descendants have no control over that. And that's part of why Tamara Lanier is making the claim to those daguerreotypes that she is. These are my descendants, and I want to have some amount of say over how people are in relationship with them in the present, because they did not have any say over that relationship in the past.
And your emphasis here on the descendants' rights to protect the memory of their ancestors is a natural segue into your discussion of Henrietta Lacks. For our readers, we have listeners. You hopefully will have readers of your book, but for the listeners of our podcast here today, would you mind reminding us of Henrietta Lacks's significance, largely in spite of herself, of course, to medical history and to bioethics in particular?
Absolutely. So Henrietta Lacks is born in 19 or yeah, she's born in Roanoke, Virginia. In the 1950s, she is diagnosed with a very aggressive form of cervical cancer. And, you know, just a few months later, she dies at Johns Hopkins. And in that time, the doctors at Johns Hopkins, her doctors at Johns Hopkins, had taken a biopsy of her cancerous cells. And they found that it was an extremely aggressive form of cancer. And for the first time, really, in medical history, they had a set of cells that could reproduce so rapidly that they could actually study cell reproduction in a lab in a way that they previously couldn't, because they just, everything else was sort of these, if you think back to your high school biology class, these sort of dead histological stains, right, that you're looking through the you're looking through the microscope, and you nothing's moving, but this cancer reproduced so rapidly that when you look through the microscope, you could actually watch it reproduce. And so the scientists were thrilled because they had something that sort of mimicked the way that the human body operates, the way cell reproduction in the human body operates. And that meant that they could run multiple tests on the same cell line. And, you know, this was a major scientific breakthrough. And so they took Henrietta Lacks's cells. She unfortunately passed away just months after her diagnosis. But they took her cells, and because they reproduced so quickly, they were able to send them out, sort of promulgate them around the globe. And they still exist today. They're called HeLa cells. The scientists kind of hid the naming. They used the first two letters of her first and last name, H-E for Henrietta and L-A for Lax, HeLa. But they said that they had taken the sample from a woman named Helen Lane. So even from the beginning, they were deceptive and disingenuous about where they had gotten this cell sample. So these cells are still used today. They've been used to help with the polio vaccine, with the COVID-19 vaccine. They've helped a lot with medical discoveries around around reproductive cancers for women and femmes, people who are women identified or biologically have, you know, like uterus and those types of cancers. And her family never consented, and they were never compensated. In fact, they were never even told that the HeLa cells had been used in all of these major medical breakthroughs over, you know, decades. And so not too long ago, along with Ben Crump, the attorney, they sued Thermo Fisher, the company, one of many companies that has been profiting from the HeLa cells. And they sued Thermo Fisher and won. And I believe they have another lawsuit pending right now. But the case of Henrietta Lacks is one of the most well-known at this point case of medical ethics or poorly handled medical ethics around informed consent in U.S. history. And so this story of the woman who survives, even though she is dead, whose cells survive, even though she is no longer with us, who continues to contribute through her cell line to our sort of daily well-being and function as a society, is just really an incredible story. And there was a period of time when some researchers put her entire genome up on the internet, and her family was really, really, really turned off by that and complained, because they argued rightfully that it made their entire medical past available to anyone to see, right? So, you know, they happen to know that they are medically sort of inclined toward a very aggressive strain of cancer. And while it's illegal in the United States for, you know, a health insurance company to deny you health insurance based on that kind of genetic data, it's not illegal for a life insurance company to deny you life insurance. So those things really do have long lasting effects on descendants, on family. You know, there are some real tangible ones that we can talk about here. So it's part of what makes Henrietta Lacks such a great case to think through.
Mm-hmm. And that in particular kind of speaks to not only the intellectual resonances of your book, but also the ethical and the legal implications of what you're asking us to think about. A few years ago, I was working on a project, and there was a bit of a disagreement between myself and the estate. And I went to the campus lawyer, and they said, well, that person has no privacy rights. Go ahead and do what you were going to do. But I was also like, well, I was hoping I didn't want to have to be like, the law's on my side. But it's interesting that, you know, you lose the privacy when you die. And then in that case with, you know, Henrietta Lacks, she lost her privacy, but her privacy also was tied up into the privacy of others, right? And we see that in digital media scholarship, right? The way that even if you're not present on social media, your friends being present on social media violates your privacy and your ability to control the information. And that leads me to the next question. That wasn't just me editorializing, sorry. So much I feel like in our popular culture and maybe even in our personal lives is tied up with this like desire to be remembered, right? And to have a legacy and a contribution. So your emphasis on this right to be forgotten and that it is a right, was really interesting and stimulating to think about. What does this concept mean for your study, especially in relationship to Black digital sovereignty in particular?
Yeah. Going back to that idea that being included in spaces that, you know, weren't created for you, that are trying to destroy you, right? There's this notion that I'm really thinking through and that I've thought through with some of my colleagues about critical refusal. And, you know, there's a conversation about critical refusal that comes out of Indigenous studies, and one that I think is also coming out of Black feminist studies in a way that I think converges nicely in my book. And I'm thinking through critical refusal in terms of, as you say, digital sovereignty, right? Rights of refusal to be able to say, no, I don't want to have to click on the yes to the cookies. And also I don't want to automatically have to allow my data to live on in perpetuity, right? That there is that we should perhaps enjoy a right to be forgotten beyond the notion of the GDPR right to be forgotten, which, you know, allows you to sue Google and say, hey, I don't want this thing about me to come up in a Google search. That's sort of the legal right to be forgotten that exists in the world. But there's then also sort of a social, moral, societal, you know, collective right to be forgotten that sort of says maybe we should be able to put and lay a body of data to rest. Right? The same way that a body is laid to rest, maybe we should be able to lay a body of data to rest, to say, we no longer need this and we're not going to resurrect it. this data is dead to us, and that's okay. That's really okay. You know, this person is dead, their data is dead. We're not going to continue to try to use this data to create a chatbot of the deceased so that we can keep talking to them. We're not going to use this data, you know, for X, Y, or Z other purpose. It was associated with that person. They're no longer with us, and they have stated their desires. And I think that's really an important part of it too. That people have an opportunity to speak to what their desires are.
So in light of this discussion, how are Black memory workers navigating, and how might they navigate these challenges that you're identifying? And you've invoked Black feminism several times. How does ethic of care inform the approaches you see available to archivists and other memory workers?
Yeah. So when I talk about an ethic of care, I'm not talking about the care that is sort of paternalistic or it's not determinism, right? It's not the kind of care that is oppressive. It's the kind of care that's liberatory. And it, when I talk about care here, what I mean is our ability to create space for different kinds of understandings of what archivy is. I had the wonderful opportunity to co-edit a special double issue of the Black Scholar on Black archival practices. And some of what emerged, some of the scholarship that emerged from that special double issue was really around what Black memory work looks like on the ground. And sometimes that looks like what other people might call hoarding, right? But if we take a perspective that understands, if we take a care perspective that understands that Black people in the United States were often dispossessed of their belongings, and that holding on to those belongings is for them an act of preservation and care, then maybe we don't view it as hoarding, and we view it as memory work, right? And so I think, again, we have this white lens and this white gaze. And when we shift that lens and we start thinking about things through a Black feminist perspective, there may be differences in how we understand a practice or understand an impulse or an instinct to keep something or to discard something. And I think that it creates more robust opportunities for us to create collective space for both remembering and opportunities for letting things go and forgetting. That's more balanced and holistic than what we have now, which, you know, as you pointed out very early on, is sort of driven by this notion of truth telling or like an authentic history or like a truth bound, fact-based, you know, whose facts, whose truth are we adhering to? Yeah.
So your book is done. It is out. I have it in my hand. It is a physical object in the world. Congratulations on that. Yes. For those at home, we are showing each other our copies of Resurrecting the Black Body. But what are you thinking about now? I mean, I know you're probably just like taking a breather and you know, enjoying your accomplishment, but, you know, we're academics, so what's next?
Well, some of the work that I do is also around community engagement. And so I'm really lucky to be here in Los Angeles, where there's a really rich Black community. And I'm also lucky to be here in Los Angeles, where there's an opportunity to create space for this kind of Black memory work. And so I've recently started a Black Memory Collective at UCLA that I'm hoping will grow and expand to be, you know, a broader initiative. And we are beginning the process of working with communities in Los Angeles, Black communities in Los Angeles, around self-documentation and, you know, and doing some Black memory work on the ground, thinking about creating a Black Los Angeles, a Los Angeles Black digital archive, where, you know, community members can contribute and also set the terms of their contributions. You know, is this something that I want to be available to everyone? So terms of access, length of preservation, you know, do I want this to be available in perpetuity? All of those kinds of things. And so the UCLA Black Memory Collective is starting some really exciting work, and I'm thrilled to be a part of that. I'm also slowly working on putting together my next project, which is thinking through, you know, it's more thinking about technology and more thinking about race and the intersection of those things, but really thinking about the ways that those things interact with our carceral systems. And so my next book project, which I'm also crafting, is on carceral technologies and the ways that we are seeing things like, you know, the way that we're seeing prisons, for example, digitize inmate mail, and then they are losing that same tactile thing that we talked about earlier, and only able, you know, you can't smell what's left of your grandmother's perfume on the card that she sent you. You can only experience it digitally, and what that digital mediation kind of does, and the ways that sometimes creates community harms. So those are the two things that I'm thinking about next in sort of this arena. And and I'm still happy to be out here talking about resurrecting the Black body, because it's been a decade of thinking about this, but the issues are actually just becoming more and more salient as we dive deeper into a world of AI and deepfakes and, Frederick Douglass, speaking of all the way back to the beginning and the archives of Atlantic slavery, you know, he had some very specific ideas about how he wanted to be represented in photographs. And now we've got deep nostalgia out here with his reanimated face shaking its head back and forth. So, you know, there are still a lot of ways that we can keep thinking about the issues that are raised by this book as well. We have an entire island, country, nation, Tuvalu, that's created a digital surrogate of itself in case it should vanish off the face of the planet. So I think, you know, there are a lot of really important conversations that to still be had about this notion of digital surrogacy, digital resurrection, digital afterlife.
Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly from my class in public and digital history from graduate school, I mean, the digital as a medium for preservation to begin with is always kind of quite shaky, right? I mean, there's so much maintenance. Right? I mean, I thought all these things that I had digitized in the early 2000s were preserved, and foolish me that the technology did not keep up with those CD-ROM.
That's exactly right.
That's a rather lighthearted comment on what you're talking about. But I mean, these are such generative questions that you're asking, and at times giving us really thoughtful ways of thinking through. And I look forward to hearing what comes out of the next project in particular, and admire greatly the work you're doing to bring together the theory and the praxis. Thank you so much for your time today, Tanya. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. The book is Resurrecting the Black Body, Race in the Digital Afterlife, available now from the University of California Press and other online booksellers. This is Pete Kunze, and this has been New Books in Media on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening, and we'll hope you'll join us again next time.